is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Today is the 150th anniversary of the death of Abraham Lincoln. It happened about 12 blocks from where I'm sitting. Louise and I have been there, the Ford Theater, apartment or the row house, townhouse, what do you call those, brownstone across the street, where he was taken and he died, is still there, and they've recreated the room with the period pieces, and, you know, it's pretty much the way it was when he died in the bed that's there. It's pretty remarkable. And it raises an interesting question. Where did the Republican Party go wrong? What has happened to the party of Lincoln? The Senate Republicans tweeted out this today. It's kind of hysterical in that, just think about this in the terms of, I've been thinking a lot about the Confederacy. You know, it's like last week was the anniversary of the surrender of Robert E. Lee at Appomattox. And, you know, arguably the end of the Civil War, although I would submit to you that the Civil War is still going on. There are all these white people in the South who are, particularly in the South, but they've spread all over the country now. I mean, you know, we're a much more mobile society than we used to be. It used to, in fact, let me make the frame even a little larger. The South used to have this incredible wealth inequality. You had very wealthy plantation owners with many slaves, and there were some poor white folks, and then you had people of color who had not only nothing, they were slaves. And then after the Civil War, they basically had nothing, and the white people in the South made sure that the people of color had absolutely nothing until the 60s, basically, with the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. And now that the Supreme Court has ripped the guts out of the Voting Rights Act, the Republicans in the South are trying to take us back to people of color not being able to vote and not having anything. Which raises an interesting question. Should we start calling the Republican Party the Confederate Party? Is it possible the Confederacy never died? It kind of went underground, and now it's come back as the Republican Party. Anyhow, the Senate Republicans tweeted this out today. Just think of this in the context of my suggestion that maybe the Republicans are actually the Confederates. And John Wilkes Booth was like, you know, on the Confederate side. Here's what the Senate Republicans tweeted. 150 years ago today, the first Republican president, Abraham Lincoln, was assassinated. America is forever indebted. I'm not making this up. This is from the official Twitter account of the Senate Republicans, Senate_GOPS. There you go. Big fail. Yeah. and then they had to reply, we like Lincoln, guys. We're not indebted to him for being assassinated. Oh, man. Come on, guys. Did you really read this? Jan Janovich tweets to the Senate GOPs, he wouldn't be a Republican today, that's for damn sure. Bradley Erickson says, you had one job, you know, basically write that tweet. Sheesh. But just consider the difference. Hillary Clinton yesterday at a meeting in Iowa where she was meeting with teachers. What Republican is going to meet with teachers and students? Hillary Clinton actually had this to say. Listen.
Yeah, we need to fix our dysfunctional political system and get unaccountable money out of it once and for all, even if that takes a constitutional amendment.
Right. Hillary Clinton, a nominee for president. I know Bernie Sanders' position on this. He's, you know, all in favor of a constitutional amendment. He's proposed one. So But you know, it doesn't. Hillary Clinton isn't necessarily the Democratic Party's nominee. It's entirely possible. I think it's unlikely, but it's entirely possible that Bernie Sanders, Martin O'Malley, Lincoln Chafee, somebody that we haven't thought of yet, might give her a run for her money. That there will be Democratic primaries, and you know, it may or may not make her a better candidate. Setting all that aside, though, just forget the candidates, because we don't know who the Republican candidate is going to be. I mean, increasingly, I'm thinking it's going to be Scott Walker and Lips Rubio. Did you see he licked his lips 77 times when he made his announcement that he was running for president? This guy's got a serious water problem. Remember when, you know, back when he did the State of the Union rebuttal, he lurched for the water bottle. I feel a little sorry for the guy. I hope he's okay. I hope this is not an indication of something like, you know, undiagnosed diabetes or something. Odds are he just sweats and licks his lips when he gets nervous. I mean, that's not uncommon. Undiagnosed diabetes among somebody who's a senator with good health insurance, that's pretty uncommon. But who knows? But Paul Krugman, day before yesterday, today is also the 15th. It's also tax day, by the way. And we should have a conversation about that. Sheriff Mack is going to be with us in the second hour. We're going to talk about policing in the United States, this whole idea of donor cops, lay cops. Anyhow, we'll get back to that. Paul Krugman points out, you know, again, the anniversary, 150th anniversary of the death of Abraham Lincoln, and I'm asking what's happened to the Republican Party. It used to be that in the Republican Party there were people, my dad was one of them, who believed that unionization was a good thing. Dwight Eisenhower in 1956 ran for re-election on the fact that he had encouraged and strengthened protections for unions and had seen union membership in the United States rise by over 1 million people during his presidency. A Republican president ran for president of the United States on that, number one. Number two, Dwight Eisenhower ran for re-election in 1956 on having not just kept Social Security, but having strengthened it and expanded it. More people, more money. This was the Republican campaign in 1956. You know, Eisenhower famously wrote that letter to his brother Edgar, where he says, you know, there are some who say that the Republican Party can do away with Social Security and trash the, I'm paraphrasing from memory here, but and trash the labor unions and those kind of things. He says there's a few, you probably know a few of these people, like the Hunt brothers in Texas. He said their number is small and they are stupid. Well, they have now taken over the Republican Party. And as Paul Krugman points out, any Democrat would at the very least maintain Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and other social programs. Any Republican would try to destroy Obamacare and cut Medicaid, and as Paul Krugman says, and probably try to convert Medicare into a voucher system. He says any Democrat would retain the tax hikes on high-income Americans that went into effect in 2013 and possibly seek more. Any Republican would try to cut taxes on the wealthy. In fact, they're having a vote this week, Republicans, on doing away with the inheritance tax, which, you know, over the next decade will take in more money than it costs. It's $268 billion. We only spend about $80 billion a year, every year, in all tuitions in all public universities. We can send every kid in America to school for free. But no, the Republicans just give that money back to the billionaires. Any Democrat, Krugman says, would try to preserve the 2010 financial reform. Any Republican is going to try and roll it back. Any Democrat's going to move forward on climate policy. Any Republican's going to roll it back. What happened to Lincoln's party?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I will share with you what happened, in my opinion, to Lincoln's party after the break. Welcome back, 15 minutes past the hour. And Tom Hartman here with you. And Jim in Lockport, Illinois. Hey, Jim, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. At least for you, it's afternoon anyway.
It is. Just 15 minutes past noon, but yeah.
Yeah, I hear you. You know, you're I just recently you had Marco Rubio talking about Hillary Clinton bringing us back to policies of the past, and that's all the Republicans have been doing for the last 20 years. They've been driving us backwards. And I want to know, why has the Party of Lincoln turned into the Party of Stinking? It's just terrible, man.
The Party of Lincoln has become the Party of Stinking. I love it. I will share a riff with you about my opinion on that in about 4 minutes. And, I want to get Camille's call in here, too, in 4 minutes. So stick around, Jim. Thanks a lot for the call. Coach Glenn in State College, Pennsylvania. Hey, thanks for watching Free Speech TV, Glenn. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, you know, I watched these shows in the evening, and the contrast between how regular people are treated by the system and judges. In the case of last night, the Georgia judge who used the RICO laws to throw the book at all-female, all-black teachers who worked the system to feed money into these corporate testing companies for working the system. And yet the bankers who work the system, what would we see if we saw a courtroom with a black judge putting these billionaire bankers in jail for spending our $1 trillion on bonuses and other kinds of crap and ruining it? How different the coverage would have been. It wouldn't have been, this is a justified thing for, my gosh, they're harming our children. It would have been, it's okay. They practically ruined the world's economy. It's just fine. I mean, there's two systems of justice. It just drives me crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Welcome to the club, Glenn. I'm totally with you. And was Lamar Waldron on the radio program here talking about the white racists in Georgia and how they set this thing up, or did we just do that on TV? I think we just did it on TV. Okay. I'm gonna see if I can maybe even today get Lamar Waldron on briefly, although that's always a challenge. Lamar tends to, you know, explain things in great detail, which is great because, you know, it can blow your mind. But try to get him on. I'll call Sean during the next break and see if it's possible or whatever. We'll see where this goes. So these teachers, they got, 7 years, something like that, Glenn?
Oh, it's 15.
15 years? Wow. 15 and they
years.
Refused to plea bargain because they were saying this really isn't our fault.
And they were basically forced into it to make the numbers.
Right.
And the testing companies are probably private corporations.
Yeah, they absolutely are. I guarantee it.
Right.
Jeb Bush's brother owned one of them.
They're like the mine workers making the money for the mine owner who doesn't care about the cave-in. But the mine owners, or in this case, the bankers, or that's part of the system.
Yeah.
You know, you never see the black judge putting a bunch of white men in jail. It's just crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I agree, Glenn. I agree. Very well said. Thanks a lot for the call. It's 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. And hang on. Senator Sherrod Brown is on the line, but Senator, hang on just a sec. Camille calling from Tunisia. Camille, can you call back in about 10 minutes and let me put you on the air then?
Okay, sure.
Great. Thank you so much. Because I want to talk about what you're doing there in Tunisia and about the GoFundMe page, but Senator Brown is on the line and I got to talk to him. So great. Thank you. Call back in 10 minutes. Senator Sherrod Brown.
Tom, I can't believe you cut off somebody from Tunisia. I'm just like down the street, really. You are such a nice guy. I just didn't see that side of you before.
This is a fellow that I have been corresponding with for about a year. He's been giving us reports from on the ground. He's a Tunisian, and an American. And on the ground there, telling us what's happening. He's blind also. And he and his family, it's gotten bad enough that they just put up a GoFundMe page. They're trying to raise enough money to flee the country, basically.
Good.
So
glad you're helping him.
Yeah. So I wanted to publicize it. Anyhow, you just came back from a rally against TPP, what I call the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, SHAFTA. Do I have that right?
Very good. Southern Hemisphere Asia Free Trade Agreement, SHAFTA.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
People said NAFTA, SHAFTA, but I've never known anybody to actually put the word together in the acronym to do it properly. You have to go to the Tom Hartman show to hear to such perfect English like that. So
well,
thank you.
Actually, one of my listeners came up with it. But
okay.
Feel free. Take it and run with it.
It's Southern Hemisphere Asia.
Asian Free Trade Agreement, yeah.
Okay.
Because it's what it is, right? I mean, you know, about a third of those countries are in the Southern Hemisphere. Most of them are in Asia, and other than us, I think. And it's a free trade agreement.
Yep.
So, anyway.
It's amazing that we just don't learn in this country on what's happened with trade. I mean, all the evidence is clearly in, and this doesn't work for us yet. The elite in this country want to continue to do fast track and then another major trade agreement. This one's really bigger than any multilateral trade agreement we've been in. This is 40% of the world's economy, as you know.
Right. So tell me about the rally this morning.
Well, rally was put on by the steelworkers. Senator Saunders was there, Congressman Ellison, a number of others. And the steelworkers have been probably the most active and engaged overall in fighting on these trade agreements. But this, what's notable on this agreement, among other things, is that this is every labor organization literally in the country, every union in the country is opposed to this. And that's never happened before, that even the more conservative unions, even the ones that sort of are dependent in part on trade, on moving goods like the longshoremen, all of them oppose this because they know what it does to jobs. They know what it does to public health laws. It's a worldwide dumbing down of health and safety rules and regulations. It's all about corporate handouts and worker sellouts. It's sort of NAFTA writ large, and it gives even more power to corporations to outsource jobs and to weaken other countries, other democratic nations, health and safety laws, food safety, worker safety, clean air, all of that.
And my understanding is that Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, and Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah, will be the co-sponsors of a fast-track bill if and when it hits the floor of the Senate. Do I have that right?
Well, you probably have that right. We expect that Hatch and Wyden will introduce a bill in the next few days. They want to move it fast. I mean, you know, you could see why. I mean, if with the term fast track is not an accident in this way, that they want to move this bill through quickly. They don't want much light shown on this bill. They don't want people to really understand what it does to weaken health and safety and environmental and food safety laws. They don't want people to understand the job impact. They don't want the wide-ranging discussion that we should and debate around, which we should have around trade agreements. So they're going to try to move this bill really fast in committee. We will have lots of amendments. We're building at my website, sherrodbrown.com/nofasttrack. We're building momentum with my colleagues and around the country. If elected officials are paying attention, we'll defeat this because the public clearly doesn't like this agreement.
All right. It seemed to me that, you know, Democrats by and large were opposed to this. Republicans by and large are promoting it, but we have a Democrat in the White House and Ron Wyden's a Democrat. What is the argument in favor of SHAFTA, of TPP?
Well, I guess you ought to ask them. But the argument in favor of it is that trade agreements knock down barriers and it will lead us to the promised land.
I mean, in theory, it's a good thing.
That. I mean, they say that every time. But interestingly, this is almost nobody I know has seen this agreement. It's almost done. It's 400 or 500 pages now. To get access to it, a senator needs to go to the basement of the Capitol. Cannot take notes and take these notes out of the room. We're in a briefing room which we use for the CIA and Department of Defense and Iran sanctions briefings. Somebody from the U.S. Trade Representative sits there as my staff and I look at it. And then when we leave, she cannot go back in without me. So the standard, this is more secretive than I'm serious. This is actually more secretive. We have less access to this trade agreement than we do to CIA and Department of Defense briefings. So what are they trying to hide? And that's why they want to move this so fast. They just don't want a public discussion of that.
I'm with you. Brown.Senate.gov, SherrodBrown.com. Senator Sherrod Brown, thank you, sir, for the great work you're doing.
Always. Thanks, Tom.
Great talking with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And we'll be back with my story on the story on what happened with the Republican Party, and we'll get Kamal's call in here as well, and yours. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, wow, what a, okay, our question, what happened to the Republican Party? On Saturday, here in Washington, D.C., and Danielle, if Kamal calls in, please let me know. I want to just toss him right on the air right away when he calls in. Saturday, here in Washington, D.C., there was, we were out walking around, and there was this big kerfuffle. The Capitol building got shut down. There was, you know, police cars everywhere. It was just, you know, it was a couple of hours in the afternoon. But if you lived here in D.C., you knew that something was going on. And if you heard the news reports, what you would have heard is that a man committed suicide, shot himself in the head in front of the U.S. Capitol building. Walked up to the U.S. Capitol building with a backpack and pulled out a gun and shot himself in the head. End of story. No droids in that car. Just, you know, keep on moving along. What was, to the best of my knowledge, not reported particularly extensively anyway in the press, was that this guy was holding a sign when he committed suicide that said, tax the 1%. Now, you'll remember that a street vendor in Tunisia who was angry with his government's confiscatory policies toward people at the bottom of the economic heap, basically, you know, tax cuts for billionaires. There's some very wealthy people in Tunisia and a lot of very poor people. And that a street vendor in Tunisia set himself on fire and died in protest of this, and that ignited the Arab Spring, arguably. So here's a guy who did essentially the same thing. He goes to the center of power and commits suicide. Instead of setting himself on fire, he shot himself in the head, but he's holding a sign that says tax the 1%. This is an article over at by 33 and a third over at Daily Kos. 33 and a third writes, on a kind of beautiful sunny day when hope springs eternal, an older gentleman wearing a backpack walked over to the fountain in front of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., and a sign. According to people who saw him, it said simply, tax the 1%. The police captain on the scene who addressed the news cameras eerily avoided the question, mumbling that it was something about social justice, as if he were annoyed to address specifics. We don't know the guy's name. A dog run over by a car might have gotten more respect in news coverage than this unknown man. And three and a third says, what kind of society have we become? A man decides to commit suicide as an act of political courage and is dismissed by both the police and the media as unworthy of further examination. How would Americans react to this story if it was widely publicized, that people are killing themselves with signs that say tax the 1%? Which takes us to what's happened to the Republican Party. The Republican Party in the 1860s, 1850s, 1860s, was a progressive reform party. Within a decade and a half, by the mid-1870s, the party of Lincoln had been, by and large, there were still some radical Republicans. Thaddeus Stevens was still around. There were still, you know, the guys who were working against slavery. That was their big issue, and working for social justice. And keep in mind, Abraham Lincoln built the Transcontinental Railroad. Now, it were actually built by and large, five large railroad corporations. But Lincoln supplied the money. Gave them, through eminent domain, billions in today's dollars worth of free land to run the railroad so it could go from coast to coast. Lincoln created the land-grant college system in the United States so that anybody who wanted to go to college for free could. This was a progressive party. But the Republican Party has been taken over by the billionaires. I mean, it's really just that simple. There's I can't think of any other way to just, you know, fundamentally say it. Dana Milbank, writing in the Washington Post, he says, give credit to Republicans in Congress. They've discovered belatedly that income inequality is a problem, and they're no longer proposing giving tax breaks to the wealthiest 2% of Americans. Now they're proposing to give tax breaks to the wealthiest 0.2% of Americans. Yep, that's the Death Tax Repeal Act of 2015, which is coming up today in the House of Representatives, which I've already, you know, ranted about at some length. But this is what has happened. I thought this was an interesting post by Cali, C-A-L-I, over at Democratic Underground. It says, okay, I take it back. When I wrote a few months ago that I wouldn't vote for Hillary if she's the nominee, someone in the long thread, I forget who, said to me confidently that I would, in the end, vote for her. Whoever you were, it didn't take getting to the end. I'll hold my nose and vote for her. I keep thinking about what would happen if a Republican wins the White House and if Repubs, which they almost surely will, retain control of the House and perhaps the Senate. The obvious, a truly heinous and backward-looking Supreme Court. Okay. But going back to my notion of basically in the Republican Party, you've got the billionaires, you got the paid shills for the billionaires, which is most of the politicians and the commentators, and you've got the suckers that they bring along with things like hating gays, hating black people, hating anybody who might want to take away their gun, that kind of thing. So the list that Cali says, you know, okay, if we get a Republican president, you're going to get more tax cuts for corporations and the wealthy. Well, those are the people who fund the Republican Party. Shredding the social safety net, that helps the funders of the Republican Party. You're going to have war, that helps the funders of the Republican Party. A nail in the coffin of women's reproductive rights, that's a sop to the suckers, the misogynistic suckers. Increasing the intrusion of religion in all aspects of public life, that's the suckers, the, you know, who think that the Republicans care about their religion. They don't. They just, you know, they need them to vote for them. Significant increase in the already bloated defense budget, that's the funders of the Republican Party. And substantive weakening of environmental laws, they'll gut the EPA, that's the funders of the Republican Party. You could identify any group within the Republican Party that's not one of those three. I would love to hear it. Camel in Tunisia. I'm not sure how to pronounce your name. Hey, welcome. How do you say your name?
Hi, Tom. It's Camel.
Camel. Hey, thank you so much. We've corresponded over the years. I've read some of your emails on the air. Tell us about your GoFundMe and what's up with your life right now.
Well, right now we are... thanks to you, and that's why really I called, is to thank you and your listeners. We got a nice start. We're up to $365, but it's still a long way from where I'd like to get to.
Right.
And ultimately, I'm trying to do a couple of things. One, get myself and family, and that's a long-term project, back from here back to the States, because things here are unraveling. And oh, by the way, you know, what the U.S. government is doing is not very helpful, I will tell you.
With drone strikes in the region or what?
Well, yes, with drone strikes in the region. Now, they have increased military funding by, you know, at least three times what it was. I think it's now up to $1.2 billion or something like that. But there's no effort to help with the economic situation, and that's getting worse, and that's making people angry.
And people get angry and they join radical groups.
Well, because, you know, one of the reasons they do is these radical groups are offering them money.
Right.
They're offering them around, I guess, a thousand euros a month, which is at least five times the living wage here.
Right. Amazing. So the GoFundMe page is GoFundMe.com/
Ben Younes family.
Ben Younes family. Thank you for pronouncing it for me. BENYOUNES family. BENYOUNES family. And we've got that on our Facebook. We put it on Facebook yesterday. It's in our newsletter, if not already. We'll get it on our homepage.
And the other thing I wanted to do, and that's part of the other thing I would like to do, is be able to get enough money. My son has a skin condition, which is prohibitively expensive here, and I just don't have the ability to help him, and it's making me nuts.
Yeah. I understand you're blind.
I am. I'm totally blind.
Yeah, and diabetic.
And diabetic.
Yeah.
So, you know, being here is tough, and one of the reasons I came back, my family and I came back, and this was before the Arab Spring. If the Arab Spring had happened while I was still in the States, I would have stayed in the States. Mm-hmm. Is because I was unemployed. You know, that I know Paul from Washington, who I like a lot, has told you before, that the unemployment rate for blind people is about 70%.
Yeah, for blind people, yeah. But you're Tunisian originally?
I'm Tunisian by birth. I mean, I was born in Switzerland. My father was a diplomat. He's passed away. We came to the States, and I lived practically the first 40 years of my life in the States.
Right. And now you're back in Tunisia. So the
and
page.
Now I'm back in Tunisia.
Yeah. You can read all about it. The page is at GoFundMe.com/. Say it, please.
Ben Younes family.
Ben Younes family. Thank you. B-E-N-Y-O-U-N-E-S family.
Hey, I want to tell you something quickly before we go.
You got 10 seconds.
I managed to get the Talking Book Program to get a couple of books on tape, so folks who don't have these sophisticated gadgets can actually read you.
Oh, that's great. Thank you, Kevin. It's great talking with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for calling from Tunisia.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
GoFundMe.com/ Ben Younes family. B-E-N-Y-O-U-N-E-S family. We'll be back. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And, wow, no free speech TV callers. Jeremy is watching us on YouTube in Glassboro, New Jersey. Hey, Jeremy, what's on your mind today?
Yes, I wanted to address your point about what's going on with the Republican Party. As we all know, the Republican Party isn't what it used to be. And I think the way to get people to actually vote in their interest, because if you cite the polls, you'll find that a majority of Americans agree with the Republicans on almost nothing, is to just dissolve the parties and make people stand on their own ideology, maybe set up a right choice voting system, an open primary, something along those lines, so people can actually try to examine the ideas instead of voting on a straight party ticket.
So how would you do that?
Well, as with any primary system, you know, You basically have two elections.
I mean, it almost sounds like what you're talking about is a parliament. Maybe I misunderstood. Maybe I had a, you know, somewhere along there I missed something you were saying. But it sounds almost like a parliamentary system where you vote for the party because of the party's principles, and the party then is elected, and the party puts up the candidates. They put them into office.
No, what I would be saying is the candidates put up themselves. And they would run, and a field of candidates, say eight people run. And then the top two candidates would phase each other off in the second election. That's what I would do.
Right. It's sort of sounds like the way they do it in California, the primaries. And you know, we've had this.
System.
Yeah, the California political primary system is a top two system where whoever the top two vote getters are. It might be two Democrats, it might be two Republicans, but that's who is in the runoff. That's who is in the general election. Primaries are party free or party inclusive or whatever you want to call it. We had this conversation with Marianne Williamson a couple of times because she ran as an independent against some Democrats.
I mean, of course, getting money out of politics is a big part of this. But I think that if people were to actually, you know, be provided someone's voting record and not focus so much on what party they are, you'll notice that like almost a plurality of people identify as independents. I'm not sure what the exact percentage is, but I think, I mean, I know it's a long shot, but I think it might go a way to have people actually understand that when they vote for Republicans, they're voting to be screwed over, basically.
Yeah. Well, and that's what we have to do. I think that, you know, the job that we have, regardless of who the Democratic nominee is pointing out that whoever the Democratic nominee is, even if it was a totally sold out corporate Democrat. I mean, if it was Joe, what was his name? The guy who blew up the public option. He's no longer with us. I mean, he's still alive, but he left the Senate. He didn't get Joe Lieberman. Thank you. Thank you, Shano. Even if it was Joe Lieberman, who is our president, you're still going to have, if you have a Democrat, somebody who's talking about and doing something about labor, about Social Security, about the social safety net, you know, about climate change. I mean, these are issues. Climate change is actually an issue that's never been an issue in a presidential election. And so, you know, there's a lot of good stuff there. Jeremy, thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Harbin here with you. And Brian in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thank you for your show and all, for always your historical teachings and perspectives are just marvelous to hear. On this anniversary of Lincoln's death, I just want to bring to you a rather heartwarming and uplifting story, actually, and amongst all of our difficult news, shall I say. There's a recreation of Lincoln's hearse back at the situation back there, you know, and it was created in a multi-state cooperative of master craftsmen from only one or two surviving photographs. And just bragging a little bit on my area, Eureka, California here, there's a nonprofit organization that enlists at-risk youth and veterans to work in the mill and worked on this project, and I think they did a fantastic job. And just to put a shout-out to the Blue Ox Millworks in Eureka, California, and encourage anybody, they're currently looking at expanding because we have increasing needs for at-risk youth and veterans in this area. And anybody who would like to, and I humbly ask that, you know, do something more than just pay lip service to issues of at-risk youth and our veterans, if they would Google Blue Ox Millworks, Eureka, California, and look at making a donation in any amount, $5 or $10, whatever. I think that it's really great. And the veterans have actually gone back to the ceremonies, and you can't imagine the amount of pride and healing that it does for veterans, as well as the work they do with at-risk youth. It's really fantastic.
Yeah. Great stuff, Brian. Thanks for sharing that with us, and thanks for calling in. I appreciate it. Matthew in Beaumont, Texas. Hey, Matthew, you have an answer to the question of what happened to the Republican Party?
Yes. Let's say the Republican Party, when it first started, was the Whigs and the Know-Nothing Party. The Whigs were pretty much liberal, you know, kind of small government, you know, and then the Whigs were, you know, nationalist and xenophobic. And just pretty much after Truman, you know, integrated the army, the party started shifting from the, you know, liberal point to it, to the Know-Nothing party. So technically they just renamed themselves back to what they were when they combined with to make the Republican Party.
Yeah. For historical context, the Know-Nothing Party was actually known as the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner. They seized control of the entire government of the state of Massachusetts in the last two decades of the 19th century, in 1880, 1890. It was one of the most poorly kept secret societies around, in that the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner, that, you know, pretty much anybody could join. And the way that you would recognize another member is with a handshake, and I don't know the magic handshake, and the phrase, I know nothing. You would shake another person's hand and say, I know nothing, and they would say, I know nothing. And it's like saying, okay, we're members of the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner. And that's why they were referred to as the Know-Nothing Party. But oddly enough, they were the ones who started public education in the United States. But they did it because, you know, Horace Mann had come to Massachusetts and with his sales pitch that, you know, we can get these troublesome youth off the streets and we can build skills for them that will make them into good factory workers and good soldiers if we set up a school system like they've got in Germany where the kids are like items on an assembly line. But I digress. Anyhow, that's an interesting analysis, the Whigs and the know-nothings. Matthew, thanks for the call. Fascinating. Alan in Albuquerque, listening on KABQ. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, mark this date down, because I think it's going to be John Kasich and Susana Martinez for the Republicans.
Well, you know, there's a certain amount of sense to that, because Kasich is, along with Scott Walker, one of the creatures of the Koch brothers. And they're going to have $1 billion in this game. And so it's got to be somebody acceptable to them. Susana Martinez, I know virtually nothing about other than that she's the governor of Albuquerque right now, is she not?
Well, she's
of New Mexico.
Yeah, and she is not what people are going to think that she is. But being Hispanic, she's going to try to, draw the Hispanic vote.
Right.
And I think between the two of them, that's what they're going to use against the Democrats this time around.
Kasich is one slick guy. I mean, look at what he's done in Ohio. What, used to be a good, solid, blue-collar construction job, factory job, state. It's solidly Democratic, solidly blue. And
his friends are with Fox News, too. So
he used to be a talk show host. Well, no, it was Mike Pence who used to be a talk show host. Kasich used to be a commentator on Fox News, wasn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
I think that's the way it's going to go after it all shakes out, because he'll be one that the rich will like and the crazies will like too once they get to know him.
There you go, Alan. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Amy in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Amy, what's up?
Oh, I belong to something called the Teal Team. It's a neighborhood team, and we worked for Obama, and we worked in 2012, 2014. On a Supreme Court judge writes that she won, yay! But anyway, what we're doing now is to reveal what the true Scott Walker is. We're writing letters to New Hampshire newspapers and Iowa newspapers, and we're getting some of them printed.
Mm-hmm.
And
to tell the story about Scott Walker. What is the story that you're telling about Scott Walker?
Well, that he has a $2 billion deficit, that he, we're one of the worst economies in the country, things like that.
That the way he has run Wisconsin into the ground, essentially, is
right,
not the way that we want
the... getting heard around the country.
Right. Yeah, it's absolutely not. I don't think anybody in the country knows that Scott Walker's created a $2 billion deficit in Wisconsin. Are you sure that that's true?
It's
an astonishing number.
It's a real big deficit,
yeah.
Because he won't take Medicaid expansion, and so
right.
That's created a lot of the deficit.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Amy, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to Madison. We will be back right after the news at the top of the hour. Sheriff Mack is going to drop by and talk about what's up with this whole volunteer cop pay-to-play thing. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Sheriff, where did my call screen go? There it goes. Sheriff Richard Mack is on the line with us, the founder of the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association, board of directors of the Oath Keepers Movement, former Arizona sheriff in Graham County. CSPOA.org is the website for the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association. Sheriff Mack, welcome back.
Well, thanks, Tom. And thanks so much for the, well, let's say the support you've given me and my family recently.
Oh, you're welcome. I think you're a decent guy, and I've it's the rough times that you've been going through are unfortunate, I think.
You and I disagree on lots of issues, and yeah, probably always will. But I don't fit the mold. I'm not your normal run-of-the-mill Republican, and I don't think you're the normal run-of-the-mill Democrat. So
no,
maybe that's where we meet.
Yeah, I think, you know, yeah. And I'm curious, this whole issue of how police are funded in the United States, I really started thinking about this back in the 90s when I took a class at the Georgia Police Academy and got some sense of what, you know, how state police were trained and what was going on and how they were paid. And it has struck me. And as you know, I lived in Europe for a year. I lived in Germany for a year, and cops there are really well paid. They have, when they retire typically in their 50s or thereabouts after 20, 25 years of service, they have, full pension. They have full health insurance their entire lives. Police officers are held to a very high standard. I believe that you have to have, I know it's certainly the case in many of the northern European countries, you have to have at least a 2-year degree in criminal justice in order to even qualify to apply to become a police officer. And cops and doctors and teachers are all paid at the very high end of upper middle class, what would be maybe $100,000 a year in today's, you know, U.S. dollars. And yet here in the United States, we've got police departments that are being funded by basically theft, by what's it called when you take the car that the crime was committed in?
Asset forfeiture.
You got that. You've got, you know, this scam that was running in Ferguson, Missouri, where they, you know, they just ticket people for small things on the bet that ticket, that they can't pay that ticket fast enough, and so it'll go to court and it'll double or triple or quadruple, and eventually you've got everybody in town owing you, you know, I mean, they generate $2 million out of 30,000 people this way. And then now we've got this guy, this 73-year-old guy who thought he was pulling out a taser, apparently, at least that's what he said, pulling out a taser and shoots this guy dead. And it turns out that he wasn't really a police officer. He was a donor to the police officers, sort of like Jamie Dimon at Chase, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase giving $4 or $5 million to the New York Police Officers Association just before they went in and trashed the Occupy movement just outside Jamie Dimon's office. It's like, work. This is crazy. Your thoughts?
It is crazy. Now, I have fought all against that. I campaigned against asset forfeiture laws. And this is what really bothers me about that and the wholesale distribution of traffic tickets, which I've written books about, by the way. I have assailed the practice of ticket violations and this type of fundraising for police departments and governments is so immoral and so wrong that I'm trying to convince chiefs and sheriffs in this country to not do what every legislature says you can do. Don't do everything that the Supreme Court has mistakenly said you can do. For instance, Gestapo-style roadblocks. And take out the word Gestapo. Roadblocks, period. I don't care for DUI checkpoints or for administrative checkpoints to see if people have their papers in order, comrade.
Right.
We do all that in America. And I cannot believe that the chiefs and sheriffs of this country say, well, the Supreme Court said we do, we said we can, so we do it. I am so appalled at that type of leadership. The Supreme Court does not run my sheriff's office. When I was sheriff, the Supreme Court did not run my sheriff's office. I looked at what they said, and I weighed that with what we had to do to serve the people and stay within our promise to uphold and defend the Constitution and to protect people's rights. And if we properly trained our officers across this country in all of those issues. Real public service. How do we avoid police brutality, and how do we get out of these situations and stay in the proper mode of protecting rights? We are the guards of the American Republic. That is what we promised to do. But yet now we are the punishers, and we are the teach this dirtbag, they use the term maggot. That's police talk.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to teach this maggot a lesson, and we're going to show this maggot who the boss is. And that's what we've seen in just recent days.
Yeah.
Far too much. Now, the one in Tulsa, that's a whole different story. That was supposedly an accident, and it's really a strange accident, I admit. But for somebody to buy their way into a reservist position, that sheriff is really going to answer for that one. And that should never be. But it's back to the money game you and I are talking about.
Yeah, it's and that money game has to do with, in my opinion, basically austerity. And I don't think that there's a political side to this. I realize, you know, the Republicans are pushing austerity.
It'll end up being one.
But, pardon?
It'll end up being one, but it should not be one.
We should be funding police. I mean, our teachers hold our future in their hands, and our police officers hold our present in their hands, and we should be funding our police departments with a reasonable tax base that allows them to do a good job and not have to, you know, scrape by or try to basically rob people. I mean, it's crazy.
Well, let's go to the asset forfeiture thing is absolutely illegal.
Yeah.
It's unlawful and illegal.
Yeah.
Because it literally puts the pressure on the officer to fudge on probable cause. So he was watching, you know, he's just sitting on the freeway and he sees somebody that looks like they're fitting the profile of a drug runner. And there are types of cars and there are types of people that are in those vehicles that fit a profile. And so then they have to fudge on probable cause to make a stop. And then they fudge on getting probable cause to search the vehicle. And then they find a big load of drugs and money and guns. And then that department keeps all the money or shares the money with other federal or state agencies. And they keep all the money from that situation, regardless of whether the person is found guilty.
Right. And I think the second state in the United States just outlawed asset forfeiture.
Which one?
I believe it was New Mexico. I could be wrong.
Well, my hat's off to them, and they should.
Yeah.
And and for any sheriff and chief to say, "Oh yeah, we got to do that because we got budgetary constraints," and for county commissioners and city councils to support this kind of activity just because it brings in the money,
yeah,
that kind of political and police prostitution is, I find, totally astonishing,
yeah,
and it's shocking that we participate in that type of a police action where we use our badge to collect funds for our own budget. That's astonishing.
Yeah, it's not just astonishing. I think it runs counter to the principles on which this country was founded.
It totally does. I mean, it totally does. And it puts the officer in such a compromising position and conflict of interest for the whole department, and from the patrol officer all the way up to the sheriff. It compromises their integrity and compromises their purpose for being there. And I can't believe we do it. And I have assailed this for years, even when I was sheriff, back in the day. And
good on you.
I have fought this.
It's an amazing thing. Sheriff Richard Mack, you have a website, don't you? This is sheriffmack.com?
Yeah, that one and the CSPOA.org.
Okay, CSPOA.org as well. Sheriff Richard Mack, thanks so much for being with us, sir.
All right.
Great talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
What do we do about that? Right. Oh, and the Bundy folks are at it again now in Oregon. I'll tell you about that. And welcome back. Let's see here. Debbie in Kingman, Arizona, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Debbie, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I'm a new fan of yours.
Thank
you. I have a question about the Republicans and Democrats.
Okay.
I know during the Civil War, the South was Democratic and the North was Republican.
Correct.
When and why did that change? Thank you.
Sure. You're welcome, Debbie. Thank you for the call. The Democratic Party originated when the country was founded, there were no political parties. There was the desire to have a federal republic instead of the Articles of Confederation. And so out of the Constitution came sort of a political movement that was called the Federalists. And the Federalists, by the middle of the George Washington administration, had actually organized themselves as a political party. Thomas Jefferson led the opposition to them with a group that was originally called the Anti-Federalists. And by the time John Adams was president and Jefferson was vice president, Jefferson changed the name of that, or the group that he was with, changed it from the Anti-Federalists to the Democratic Republicans. And by the 1820s, they dropped the word Republican. And so the Democratic Party pretty much started way back then. And it was a progressive party originally because the Federalists had become, John Adams' Federalists had become basically total corporatists and fascists. And so Jefferson's attempt to push back on that was pretty aggressive at the beginning of the Democratic Party. But by the 1830s or thereabouts, the Democratic Party basically was the party of Southern slavery, which makes sense. I mean, Jefferson was a Southern slave owner, and a lot of the early Democrats came out of Virginia and came out of the South. And so that infected the Civil War. A lot of the Confederate soldiers were also Southern Democrats. And then the anti-slavery party was the Republican Party and the so-called Progressive Party. And the Republicans were progressive for about a decade and a half, but the Democrats were still kind of a retrograde pro-slavery party. And they held that position right up until the 1920s. And in the 1920s, this great, and in fact, the Republicans, again, had been the progressives at the turn of the century in 1901 when, McKinley was assassinated and Teddy Roosevelt became president. You had progressive Republican there, and you had a progressive Republican in Taft taking on the big corporations. So the Democrats became progressive after the great crash of 29. And FDR came into office in 33 as a progressive Democrat, and created literally out of nothing the legal infrastructure in which unions could exist in the United States with the Wagner Act in 1935, the National Labor Relations Act. And as unions grew and strengthened, the Democratic Party continued to become the party of the working person, whereas the Republican Party at that point shifted to, well, they had been sold out since the 1870s, basically to the highest bidders. They were the party of the railroads, the party of the oil companies, the party of the the steel barons, the banksters, and they still are. So they're, to this day, the Republic. But the Democrats have been relatively progressive and solidly Democratic since the 1930s. Hope that little arc of history, Debbie, thank you for the call. Hope that little arc of history lesson is useful to you. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, and Fred in Hillsboro, Maryland. Hey, Fred, what's on your mind?
Well, you just talked. I just finished reading a book called The Bully Pulpit by Doris Kearns Goodwin, and it's a great history lesson of where we came from, and that's where, to me, that the entire right-wing symphony wants to take us back to, a time of no workman's comp, no EPA, and basically the Gilded Age, which was all gilded for the 1%ers.
Right.
And it was a great story. It was a great read, and it's true. And what brought us out of that was the an elite press.
Yeah.
People like McClure and Anna Tartable that were able to write and get over the right wing symphony that we have right now that will try to shout out, drown out, coordinate a coordinated effort to keep down what they're really all about.
Yeah, and really until the 80s when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, and then the 90s when Clinton signed the 1996 Telecommunications Modernization Act, Up until that point in time, our media was largely fractured and independent. Television had grown up with three big networks, but even then you had ownership rules about you know, you had local ownership of television stations all over the country. And now, as a result of the ownership rules being blown off and no longer enforcing the Sherman Act, we've got basically six corporations that control pretty much everything we see, hear, and read, or at least 90% of it. And that's not a good thing for democracy. So the book is The Bully Pulpit by Doris Kearns Goodwin. I'm going to have to check it out. Did it just come out, Fred?
Well, it's about three things. It was about Roosevelt, Taft, and the journalist period of the time, S.S. McClure, McClure's Magazine, which was the beginning of the muckraking journalist, and how brilliant.
Oh, interesting.
It's never been recreated since then. It was had to do as much about the press at the time, what could shine a light on the conditions, on what's going
right.
on. I mean, it's like Standard Oil. How many more times do Exxon Mobil and everything have to merge before they will become back to the original Standard Oil?
Well, they're much larger than the original Standard Oil now.
Exactly. And
yeah.
I have one more thing to say.
Sure.
And this is about a favorite book of yours and mine. I know who killed John Galt.
Who? By the way, before you answer, for people who don't know what we're talking about, the existential question that's raised in Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged novel is who killed John Galt? So go for it.
Yeah.
Who did?
People drive him crazy. Ayn Rand killed him.
Oh, of course.
She created the characters on both sides of the fence.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she is the one that really killed him, because the industrialists are not like, they're like, to me, like Bill Gates. Back 20 years ago, he was ruthless. Now he's supposedly giving all his money away. They want to portray him as being, you know, the industrialists as being benevolent, good, when they really, they're smart, blood-sucking people.
Yeah, yeah. Well said, Fred. Thank you for the call. Clara in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, Clara, what's up?
How are you doing, Tom?
Good. How are you?
I'm well. I just want to say I appreciate your show so much. I just started watching now. It's been about 2 weeks. And I'm telling you, I have learned so much.
Well,
but the thing I wanted to call about was, you know, I heard you say something the other day about Bush. And it just amazed me, because it was almost like he disappeared after all the mess he started.
Yeah.
He did so many wrongs. And then when Obama came, it was almost like they dumped everything off on Obama. And it was like, oh, this is Obama's fault. But really, it was all of the leftovers from Bush.
Yeah, we were losing 800,000 jobs a month when Bush left. The economy was in the tank. The stock market was lower than it had been since the Great Depression, if you inflation adjust it. I mean, George W. Bush left a screaming, half the world hated us. We had two active wars going on that were illegal and unnecessary. We had tens of thousands of wounded soldiers and thousands of dead soldiers, not to mention millions of dead Iraqis and Afghanis, I think you call them Afghans.
It was a mess. And, you know, the other day I heard you mention Bush, and it was just so amazing. I said, oh, my God, I've learned history from you, things that I did not know about the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, how this sheriff that just got off, I commend him, because it is so terrible to see what the police are doing now, the Justice Department. But I know they're being underpaid. I know that in all the states. I know that they
The Sheriff Mack that I was just talking to, he's kind of a hard right ideologue, and therefore he won't take Obamacare, and so he has no health insurance because he doesn't get health insurance as a retired sheriff, which I think is a crime. I think anybody who's, you know, put in their time and, you know, should have, you know, if particularly with a state employee, something like that, you know, or a very large company. But he had a heart attack and he had no health insurance. I mean, it's rough stuff.
Wow. You know, it's something. I don't know. I just don't know what happened to Obamacare, but I don't believe in my heart that what we have now was what he started off as Obamacare. I don't know what happened, but it's almost as if anything that this man came up with, this, because they haven't allowed him to be president.
Yeah.
You know, he's my president, but they They chopped anything that he said. I don't care. They could have said it first. And he could have came and said, okay, I agree with it. Yep. Then they disagree with it.
That's, you're absolutely right. And, in fact, that has happened multiple times. In fact, Obamacare was originally proposed by Richard Nixon in 1972. It was put into place by Mitt Romney in 2000 and, or thereabouts in Massachusetts, Romney Care. It was a Republican idea. It was come up with by the Heritage Foundation. The person who blew up Obamacare was Joe Lieberman. Joe Lieberman was the one vote that they needed on that to get that thing out of committee. And he said he would not vote for it, for the Obamacare bill, if it contained a public option. So they stripped the public option out of it to satisfy Joe Lieberman. And, you know, the guy who used to be a Democrat and then couldn't even win his own Democratic primary. So he ran as the senator from Connecticut on the independent ticket against the Democrat, won, and, you know, was in the Senate for another 6 years, long enough to screw up Obamacare. And now he's, you know, back to yelling he wants some more wars or something. I have no idea what Joe Lieberman's up to now, but that's where it happened. Clara, we're out of time, but thank you so much for the call. Great to hear from you. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. Thank you very much, Clara. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
What do we... How do we awaken America to the fact that there's really only three groups inside the Republican Party? Welcome back, Tom. I've been here with you 28 minutes before the hour. Okay, Annie from Wisconsin said that Scott Walker's leaving a $2 billion hole in the budget. Here's an article by Scott Bauer with a photo from the Associated Press. Oh, this is an Associated Press story. So this is, from the AP. Dateline Madison. This is from January of this year, just a couple months ago. Governor Scott Walker will have to plug a roughly $280 million budget shortfall by the end of June, and the state faces a two-year deficit that could be as large as $2 billion based on new estimates released Friday by the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau. Right. Amazing. Amazing. I am increasingly failing to understand how any Republican can genuinely run for political office in the United States and tell the truth. I mean, how do you... Chris Christie tried it yesterday, right? Or the day before yesterday. Came out and said, okay, yeah, you know, it's... We're going to do... See, he screwed up the pension program for the state of New Jersey. Raised the retirement ages, reduced the benefits. I mean, he screwed it up. And so he says, hey, we're going to do for the country what I did for New Jersey. We'll raise the retirement age for Social Security up to 70. We'll raise the eligibility age for Medicare up to 67, 68. We'll raise, we'll cut benefits for people who make over $80,000 a year. And we're going to means test it. We're going to turn it into a welfare program. At least Chris Christie was honest, but he's not going to get elected on that. What can a Republican say? Other than that Democrat's a terrible person, which is what you're going to hear an enormous amount of. I mean, it's just going to be mind-boggling how much that's going to be blowing around. But what can Republicans run on? But they want to cut Social Security, they want to cut Medicare, they want to cut Medicaid, they want to do away with public education, and, voucherize everything, then privatize it. They want to, we've had Republican privatization now for 30 years. I mean, since Reagan really pioneered this in the 80s of our military, of pretty much anything. I mean, anything that government does for free or for inexpensive, shall we say. I mean, the cost to administer Social Security is less than 2%. The cost to administer Medicaid and Medicare is less than 3%. Whereas a private for-profit health insurance, the cost to administer it is 15-20%. Sometimes, before Obamacare, it was a lot more than that in many cases. Administration, including the money that they're skimming off the top. But what can a Republican run on? We want to beat up more minorities? You know, they want to chase more buses full of people coming from Mexico, little children coming from violence in Honduras or Guatemala or El Salvador, violence that's the consequence of Reagan's policies in the 80s in that region. I guarantee you what they are going to run on is going to be wedge issues. They're going to say, oh, you know, as Bill O'Reilly said, apparently day before yesterday, if you're white and Christian, there's a war on white male Christians. Really? Last I looked, Christian white guys have it pretty good in this country. I'm just astonished. I don't get it. How they're going to do this. David in San Francisco. Hey, David, what's on your mind today? David, how you doing? David's listening to his radio or TV instead of the phone. Rebecca in Everett, Washington. Hey, Rebecca. Can you hear me?
Hey, Tom. Good morning. I want to address three of your questions. Whatever happened to Republicans?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we make American people up? And then what we need from our champion that you asked the other day.
Okay.
Whatever happened to our Republicans is, the last time I knew, when you ran for public office or when you took a government job, you were there to do your duties of that job. And it wasn't to answer to big money and to give them what they want. That was always considered a conflict of interest,
right?
I believe is what they call it. And I call it something else. And number two, how do we wake the American people up? The American people are smart. They smell the corruption. They know it's there. And something has to be done about that before we can get to the big problems that we've got, you know, Social Security and everything else. And they're all important, trust me.
Mm-hmm.
But number one, our champion has to, first of all, get the elephants out of the room, so to speak. And I'm sorry that, you know, pertains to the Republican Party with elephants. But anyway, that's what has to be done.
I think you're right.
Our champion has to talk about Citizens United and not just allude to it, because Americans want straight talk. They want the truth.
Yeah.
And like Elizabeth Warren gives and Bernie Sanders gives.
Yep.
But they never get to be heard because they don't get the quality news or whatever they want to call it report.
No, I'm totally with you. Here are the words of Dwight David Eisenhower, President of the United States, November 8th, 1954, 2 years into his presidency. He said in a letter to his brother Edgar, and I quote, "Should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you would not hear that party again in our political history." There's a tiny splinter group, of course, that believes you can do these things. Among them are Texas oil millionaires and an occasional politician or businessman. But their numbers are small and they are stupid. That was Dwight Eisenhower. So, you know, there's lessons in the past. Rebecca, thank you for the call. David in San Francisco. Hey, David. Still there?
Well, howdy, Tom.
Hey.
Yeah, I called you last week, and I was you were also talking about police abuse, and I gave you a kind of a positive direction to go, and that was to, you know, follow the money.
Right.
That was, of course, the adage from Deep Throat in Watergate.
Yep.
And I noticed in Chicago they seemed to have a pretty good protest. I believe it was last night. Sounded like there were hundreds of people out there protesting police abuse. So maybe they were listening and they caught on to that contest, whether we can get the there's a contest between Chicago and San Francisco about who can get their police chief fired first. And I also mentioned last week the Missouri auditor had been doing a study about police corruption, and he had discovered, if you go to the Missouri auditor's webpage, you can see his final report before he suddenly died. It's claimed that he committed suicide, but I don't believe it. His final study showed three different levels of theft. One was about $7.5 million missing from the Department of Corrections makes license plates and furniture and things like that. So there was about $7.5 million missing from that.
Mm-hmm.
But you had been just talking about the asset forfeiture.
Right.
And that asset forfeiture is a big part of his report, and it involves many millions, and it's a very difficult one to follow because they may capture, you know, cars, boats, you know, SUVs, all sorts of different houses, farms, all sorts of different things throughout the state of Missouri, and you know, who gets to keep it, whether it's kept in a quiet place and never brought up for auction or given over to some other agency and then used for a playground. So the idea that the asset forfeiture is a big part of this corruption. And so I was going to just remind people, if they want to study the money, look at the Missouri auditor's death and his final report. He also, the third part of his report also included there were cash payments to the executioners without receipts. And if you remember...
So to preserve their anonymity?
Well, it wasn't just that. As you probably know, you know, the executioners, especially in a medical-induced execution, the AMA or the Missouri Medical Association is going to disbar any doctor that takes part in an execution.
Right, so they're getting EMTs to do it, is my understanding.
Or veterinarians or anybody else.
Right.
But even the veterinary society, the pharmaceutical societies, they're all going to disbar anybody that takes part in it.
Right. And so,
they're using illegal drugs, whether they're using bootleg drugs, it becomes not just a kind of a criminal behavior, but that they were paying out cash money without receipts to executioners. And even the auditor strangely ends up dead when he starts studying it.
What was the name of this auditor?
I think it's Shiker.
Okay.
He just died about a month and a half ago. He was about to have a press conference in 20 minutes, and then all of a sudden he's dead with a single bullet wound to his...
This wasn't the guy who died and then his spokesman also died?
I didn't catch anything about it.
Okay, I'm thinking of a different case then. There's another one of those kind of spooky deaths out there that has happened in the last few months
Yeah.
Well, we'll see.
Following the money, that to me is the big issue. These guys are, you know, they're dealing with cash money. When you start doing asset forfeiture, then they start bootlegging things. You don't
right.
know what they're taking from cars and boats.
Yep. It is an interesting time, David. Thank you very much for the call. The good news is that we're having these conversations, that Americans are waking up, that the game is rigged and not in a good way, that, you know, so much damage has been done to our governmental agencies. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
For your calls, Talk Radio News Service, all coming up. Stick around. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jim, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Vida, Montana. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Say, you know, you're talking about these guys that want to ride around, you know, and play sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
Vigilante types like George Zimmerman, this guy now, whatever it was, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he pulled the taser. Well, you know that Ted Nugent does that?
No. He gives police departments money and then he rides around with guns?
Well, I don't know about giving him money. You know, he's got a lot of money. He probably does. But this was on the Outdoor Channel. You know, he's got a ridiculous hunting show on there. I mean, I hunt too, but I mean...
I've never seen it.
He's a real doofus. He's got a hunting show on Outdoor Channel. Anyways, a couple of 3 years ago, I saw him riding along. He's a deputy sheriff in Texas someplace, riding along with the sheriff's department, and they were busting down doors and that.
Oh, this was in Arizona with Joe Arpaio, right?
No, this is Ted Nugent riding along with the...
Right, but I mean, it was Ted Nugent riding along with Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona.
Oh,
it wasn't. So he's doing... Okay, Shano insists it is. But maybe he's doing it. Maybe he's doing it in multiple places. I mean, it's entirely
possible. I thought it was in Texas because he's big in Texas. You know, he's got property down there and that. But maybe it was in Arizona. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, maybe it was. But
yeah, it doesn't. Yeah. It doesn't matter. Whatever it is, Jim, you've identified a problem with our police departments, and B, you know, Crazy Ted. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Liliana in Bozeman, Montana. Hey, Liliana, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Love your program.
Thank you.
Tom, I am puzzled, frankly, bugged that a lot of people who don't have a candidate of their choice on the ballot, they're having tantrums and rather not go and vote. The other night I watched the program and this woman was having tantrums over if the Hillary going to be on the ballot, she would not go and vote. Now, what kind of nonsense is that?
Right.
If 7 million Americans decide we don't like Hillary, we will end up with a tea bagger in the White House.
You're right.
Because if she don't vote, that's vote for other side.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Basically, every person who doesn't vote is the equivalent of a vote for the other side. And that's that's the goal of negative advertising. The goal of negative advertising, of attack advertising, which is all you're seeing right now from the Republican Party, all directed toward Hillary. There's a great piece about it in today's New York Times, how this gang is forming of all these different, this coalition of all these different anti-democratic groups, the anti-labor groups, anti-environment groups, or shall we say pro-billionaire, pro-big business groups, getting together to just totally trash Hillary Clinton because she's the presumptive Democratic nominee. And if anybody else pops their head up enough that, you know, they're a serious contender or a possible contender for the race, they will go after them too. So
the problem is, you know, what bothers me is why people don't understand that. You know, Hillary is not my first choice either. I want Elizabeth or Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
But next year in November, I'm going to drag myself over there and I'm going to vote for whichever person going to be on my ballot for the president.
Yeah.
For my party.
No, this is what I've been saying all along, is whoever the Democratic nominee is, I'm going to vote for that person because the environment, the Supreme Court, I mean, there's a lot of subtle areas where we could say, oh, this person isn't, some of them actually not even so subtle. This person isn't good enough, or this person should have that policy or whatever. But with regard to some really cardinal things like the survival of the human race, we're talking about the environment, or, you know, it's just the Democrat, regardless of who it is, will take a rational, science-based position, and the Republican is going to be a shill for the Koch brothers in the oil industry. Liliana, thank you very much for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Ten minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, and find out what's going on in the world. This is brought to you by the story of Sholene and Kier. Kier is the slave from South Sudan. You can see the story at thanklist.com/watch. Bob Ney, Congressman, welcome.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am fine. I should add the author of Sideswiped, a great book about how Washington, D.C. really works. What's going on in the world here today, Bob?
Well, we have two international, and then we can go to the presidential. That's always good for a story,
okay?
I think. The two international, which are domestic policy, actually, issues. But Cuba is off, as we know, the, quote, terror list. The presidential candidate, Senator Rubio, has a problem with that, and he did actually a piece against it, including one in Spanish. But it was interesting what he came up with, which was the fact that fugitives have went to Cuba, which there have been some people, as we know, for example, Mark Rich went to Switzerland, but who had, you know, ripped a ton of people off. But then there was a fugitive who had an incident and she had killed some people and she went to Cuba. That's not exactly an international terrorism incident.
No.
That's a criminal.
In fact, I think the only, and it's been some time, I think the only folks that, you know, where you could say Cuba has supported terrorists, in quotes, are back in the 70s when there were, you know, disgruntled Americans who were hijacking aircraft down to Cuba and Castro was giving them refuge. I mean, that's
exactly.
I don't know of anything that they've done beyond that. I mean, they could make a strong case against us. I mean, we've tried to assassinate Fidel Castro 50, 60 times. He's got a museum dedicated to it down there in Havana. But anyway, back to you, Bob.
I just thought it was interesting. That is the only argument that he could make. And nobody else is bringing up, you know, Al-Qaeda or some type of infiltration of terror groups or Castro spending money to send them around the world, which we can say about other countries. But really, nobody can say that about Cuba. So the Congress itself actually doesn't say to the president, well, yes, we're for you or against you on this one. They have no legal authority. Now, they can pass their own bill That's not even going to happen. It's not going to come near it happening. It's not going to have any type of, you know, vote out of a committee or anything of that nature. This is done. So this was the last piece. Now, the Congress can refuse to lift the embargo, but frankly, now that the Cuba is not on the terrorist list and the fact that we are beginning the process with Cuba and it will open to the world and a whole lot of other United Nations implications, it basically will now come back into the Western Hemisphere by all rights. And I think, you know, people will see some changes down there.
But so lifting the embargo requires an actual proactive, positive action by the Republican Congress. Do I have that right? Both the House and Senate would have to pass.
That's right.
Okay. So they're going to have, you know, right wing hate radio and Fox so-called news all over them when they do this, if they try to do this. You think they can pull it off?
You know, they might let it set a while, but nature is going to take its course on this.
Yeah.
But there are people that are going to go down there. They're going to start being able to see their relatives. The relatives will be able to travel here. Nature will take its course to where this embargo will become seriously irrelevant.
Yeah.
So even the Republican Congress at some point in time, if it stays in their control, is going to have to yield to the change because it's going to go with or without them on that.
Yeah.
Now, the Iran deal, Tom, is really fascinating. Because now you have a bill that came out unanimously, and the issue when I talked to you on your show yesterday was a different issue. The issue was the fact of the Congress wanting to weigh in on the deal, saying yes or no to the deal. Now that still remains, except two major changes to that bill. So it wasn't as if all of a sudden President Obama said, oh, you got me, I've got to go along with you, I'm not going to veto it. There were two significant changes to that bill. One being the fact that the White House will not be required to make sure that Iran does not promote international terrorism, which it can't anyway. That was a hopeless spike in that bill to kill any form of an agreement. We can't certify that. There's no way. But the other one is that the Congress will undergo, when a deal comes through in June, a 30-day review instead of a 60-day review. As I talked to a couple of my friends on the Hill today, and we laughed about it, you know, technically the White House is saying, yes, it'll be a 30-day review. Probably a staffer behind the scenes is saying, as you know, Mr. President, they can't do anything in 30 days. So the Congress will have a limited period of time to interact with that deal. Then they will send a piece of legislation back to the president. They'll have to craft one. Then if the president doesn't like it, he can veto it. And at that point in time, he can actually, you know, as long as he has 34 of the Senate Democrats with him, he becomes veto-proof.
Right.
So there's a long process. Now, the House and Senate are going to say, you see, we're weighing in on this, but actually the negotiations will still continue with the president through Secretary of State Kerry and Javid Zarif through the Iranians, no matter
right.
what's
But the net of this is if this legislation passes, and Republicans might be now, as it goes to the House, starting to figure out that they're basically putting themselves in a box with this piece of legislation, if I'm reading this right.
Oh, you're correct.
Something much more toxic might come out of the House, and they might not be able to reconcile it, and, you know, it could be nothing, too.
They're going to have floor amendments, potentially, or Boehner will have to not have floor amendments, then he'll have a problem. And if you notice, the House on the Republican side has been remarkably quiet. You can hear crickets over there.
Yeah.
They just have not waded into this in the sense of how they're going to handle it. Will they be veto-proof? Now, at this point in time, the Democratic side could go along with this because Iran, the negotiators, are not going to view this as a death spike to talking to the United States. And if we want to talk about verification, you know, everybody has a different opinion. Now, I will weigh in on the fact that on Capitol Hill, it's no secret that philosophically, Senator Schumer on the Democratic side, who has supported the Republican Senator Corker on this, has some personal beliefs and some constituencies where he weighed in on this. But Tom, on the Republican side, some of it has absolutely nothing to do with belief. It is just a sheer dislike of President Obama and not wanting him to win one, quote, on foreign policy.
Right. Well, that's been the commitment of the Republicans ever since January 20th, 2009, when the caucus room conspiracy was hatched.
And this is a dangerous one to have that type of attitude on, because there's only one way to try to check Iran, and it's through being able to have a trust and verify situation with them.
Amen. And you would know that better than anyone else in Congress. You're one of the few who speaks Farsi. Congressman Bob Ney, author of Sideswipe. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and I'm very pleased to have here in the studio with me Alan Minsky. He's the program director of KPFK, Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, so we're pleased to be on the air. He's also the son of the celebrated economist Hyman Minsky, and there is a conference put on, is this the Levy Institute?
The Levy Institute, correct.
L-E-V-Y Institute.org. Here in Washington, D.C. Tell us about it, Alan.
Well, it's a conference they put on every year. My father was a professor at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, and when he retired, he moved over to the Levy Institute, which is sort of an economic think tank, mm-hmm. generally is a would be associated as a progressive, politically progressive economic think tank, but they really are a serious macroeconomic think tank. Most of the work is done in loosely the Keynesian tradition, but, you know, there's some radical economists, there's some less radical Keynesians who've been associated, but they really follow macroeconomic financial regulation. My father was a very peculiar left progressive economist in that he focused upon the role of banking. And he had a particular theory that he was famous for called the financial instability hypothesis, that the briefest summary of which is stability is destabilizing in financial markets, and basically that the compulsion when you have a stable market for people to take excessive risks is excessive, and without regulation and some kind of adult oversight, these things lead to bubbles and then they burst. Well, my father was somebody who was in the Keynesian tradition, and if you look at Keynes and the general theory, his great theoretical work, has sections on banking. Well, my father looked at those and expanded upon those. And, of course, what we've seen in the global economy and in the American economy is the role of finance has increased exponentially over the most recent decades. And so within a Keynesian framework, my dad's theories about the role of finance and banking have now become the subject of much study and focus around the world.
And maybe we are setting ourselves up by the great deregulations, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Not Herbert Hoover, but who was elected in 1920? It was Harding.
Warren Harding, right.
Warren Harding was the great deregulator. I mean, mm-hmm. he ran on a mm-hmm. platform literally of more business in government, less government in business. In other words, deregulate and privatize. And that led right to the crash of 29.
Right.
And then we got this massive deregulation at the end of the Clinton presidency in 99 and 2000 with these bills put forward by the Republicans, particularly Phil Graham, mm-hmm. that deregulated the banks. And mm-hmm. now, so, you know, the crash of 2016 on its way?
Well, could be prescient. But the speaker, the keynote speaker that was just speaking at the conference was Senator Elizabeth Warren. Of course, it was a very high political drama to have Senator Warren, of course, now one of the central figures in American politics.
What did she say to you guys this morning?
Well, it was.
And thank
it was
you for inviting me. I'm sorry.
Very focused and very succinct and very powerful. And this was right in her wheelhouse. I mean, she talked about the need for the strengthening of the Consumer Protection Agency, that, of course, was what she was originally brought to Washington to work on by President Obama. the need for that, what its successes has been. But then she talks straight up about regulation and then the various realms in which regulation needs to be strengthened. And she said straight up that, you know, regulation is a friend of markets, that the GOP is pursuing a radical anti-market agenda. Because when you don't have rules, when you don't have regulation, you encourage cheating. And when you have cheating, you have deformed markets.
Right. And the metaphor that I use to explain that to people who don't get it,
right,
is, you know, they say, well, I want, you know, free markets, right? I want free trade. I want free, you know, whatever. And my response is, would you ever want to play in a free football game?
Yeah, there we go. Right. Sure.
You know, whichever team has the most money gets to pick where the goalpost is going to be.
Which is where it is. And at the end, boy, did she hit on that. She said this is an economic problem and this is a political problem.
Right.
And she cited an instance where Citibank put some rider into a bill that would, if it wasn't passed through, was going to shut down the government. And Jamie Dimon was on the phone to the politicians themselves before the vote.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, who is going to get their calls answered,
right,
you know, by congresspeople other than somebody with that kind of power, that kind of money? But she went through it bit by bit. And I have to say, you know, obviously one of the big issues politically in the country has been is will Elizabeth Warren be running for president? And certainly on this subject, her charisma. And this is a group of professional economists, and they were exhilarated by her performance. It was an incredible speech, and this is again on her wheelhouse. And on this subject, you could not have a more powerful champion of the American people on where the field is today institutionally. And by the way, she called for institutional structures, but it changes, by which she meant the banks are too big. You have to directly address the fact that we have 11 financial institutions in this country that if any one of the 11 were to collapse, they would bring down the economy as what happened in 2008. And she said simply, and again, the way the government is dealing with this, the regulators are not on the beat effectively. She said the Fed has to be more on top of regulating the banks. They slap them on the hand once. They go out and they cheat again. They slap them on the hand again, and they're never punished. The SEC and the DOJ are also too lax. So she went through all of that. But she also said she was very adamant that the banks are too big. The banks have to be broken up. And so she's calling for regulation, but not the type of, like, every nook and cranny has to be regulated, which has to be the cause when you have 11 massive banks. But if you break up the banks, then you have, you know, less line-by-line detail, 1,000 pages of regulation. They're tighter, they're simpler, they're more streamlined as well. So she was, you know, it's the type of thing that I think any average citizen would hear and would really be swayed by.
And if you break up the big banks, if you break up these banking, essentially, monopolies, competition, I don't want to sound like a libertarian or a Friedmanite, but competition does introduce a level of its own kind of natural systems regulation.
Right.
So, you know, because you're going to have competitors saying he's not playing by the rules.
Right.
They're going to be calling each other out. They're going to be, you know, things like that.
So this has to be an integrated system that works well. The regulators have to be seen as the allies of the honest players in the marketplace.
Right. And right now you've got a bunch of banks that hate the regulators. They're doing everything they can to do away with the regulations. They're buying politicians like there's no tomorrow. You know, this is a very seriously bad situation. As a person who really understands economics, we're talking with Alan Minsky, by the way, a program director at KPFK in Pacifica, son of the celebrated economist Hyman Minsky, and he just came from, and I think you're going to go back to a gig that you guys are doing today at the Levy Institute, Levy, L-E-V-Y, Institute.org is the website, where Elizabeth Warren just spoke, and it's a lot of this is all about, you know, the work that your dad did. What are your thoughts on the U.S. and the world economy right now?
Well, I'll answer that, but I want to say something because I think this is I come to this interview with one very important point, which I think you'll love, Tom, which is that I really think in the United States right now we effectively have four branches of government. You know, the Constitution is written as third. But when you look, and this relates to the global economy and the American economy, when you look at the powerful institutions of the American government, obviously there's a judiciary, executive, congressional, and the truth is nothing is more significant and powerful right now than the Federal Reserve. Why is that? Because the GOP has basically blocked any fiscal remedies on the economy, and therefore the only institution that can operate to make significant macroeconomic shifts in the economy is the Fed. And I do think when you have Janet Yellen as opposed to Bernanke, who was better than Greenspan, but by the time you get to Yellen and away from Greenspan, you do have someone who does consider the welfare of working people. And I think this is important. When people talk about who will you know, put in the next Supreme Court justice. And I'm not here to give talking points to the Democratic Party, but I think people should recognize that, you know, Yellen is an appointee by Obama who would not have been appointed by a Republican, and that's very significant.
Yeah, and Greenspan, the Republican appointee, was the guy who basically took the whole thing down.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. It's like Greenspan and his. He was so in love with Iran, he took a 6 foot dollar bill floral arrangement to her funeral, and he was initiated into her cult in her apartment in 1956 in New York City.
Incredible history. Yeah,
it really is. It really, you know, it's astonishing that this guy was the head.
And
of
it goes hand in hand with the right wing that was marginalized in the 50s and 60s, and then boy, the reaction came forward, and boy, did they realize the game was to fund the think tanks. You know, the people have capital, the people have money, fund the think tanks, and it's in the government, and boy, it changed history, and it's a tough history.
Yeah, amazing thing. Alan Minsky, program director with KPFK and the son of Hyman Minsky, Levy Institute, LevyInstitute.org the gig. Elizabeth Warren just spoke there, and we'll be back. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tom.
We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be right back with more. Stick around. Pardon? Welcome back. Alan Minsky with us, program director for KPFK Pacifica and the son of Hyman Minsky, LevyInstitute.org, the website. Alan, you said you were going to answer my question about the U.S. and the world economy.
Well, look, please. The great hope for the U.S. economy is things like Fight for 15. Because, again, if you want a
fight for $15 as a minimum wage or as a living wage.
If people stand up and fight now that we're not in the immediate realm of the financial crisis, right? We're out of that particular territory. Institutions have stabilized. Everything Elizabeth Warren is saying about the need to change the institutions and then increase regulation is right on point. But really getting money into the hands of middle-class people and working-class people, I think the American economy needs that. How is the global economy and the American economy? It's very, very difficult for working people. And so we're at a point now where there are more people employed, but they're not making enough money. And this is across the entire world. And as long as that's the case, I mean, once you get more working people getting more money in their pockets, they can spend more money in markets, and the economy becomes more vital. Now, leaving aside every kind of, you know, huge theoretical question about which kind of economy do we want in our utopia, if you're talking about the performance of capitalist economies on the global stage and the American stage, we need to have more money in less debt and less just pressure of debt hanging on families and on working people. So right now, I think it's a great day to see the Fight for 15 going on around the country, and hopefully the political classes around the world will recognize that a healthy economy is one in which working people really have money in their pockets.
Wow, well said. So net-net, if we want an economy to work, we need to feed it from the bottom up rather than the top down.
Absolutely, yes.
And which means create demand. You create demand by giving people who are going to spend all of their income more income, and which is basically raising the minimum wage, raising the living wage, and thus you can stabilize your economy. But you said our economy now is fairly stable. Isn't that a warning? Isn't that a warning, Will Robinson, based on your father's theories?
I think if you get into a situation, yes. Do I think that's going to happen, what I said should happen? Quite frankly, no. I think the institutional structures, what Elizabeth Warren's saying, is it going to happen? As powerful as Elizabeth Warren is, do I think we're going to break up the 11 big banks? No. Do I think we're going to see the middle class return back to the prosperity of the 50s, 60s, and 70s? No. It's what needs to happen. If it doesn't happen, right, then we have an incredibly fragile economy, and your Crash of 2016 is a very important book for people to read.
Whoa. Whoa. Well, and you know, when I wrote that book, I mean, it was partly, oh, my God, but it was also partly this could be an opportunity. I mean, every crash that we've had, every major crash we've had, you know, the mm-hmm. 1920s, the 1850s, the mm-hmm. 1770s, late 1760s, early 1770s, every one of those led to, yeah, I mean, terrible stuff over the short term, but major progressive transformation of this country over the long term.
Right. Well, right now, again, the fiscal solutions are pretty much off the table. By the way, Elizabeth Warren spoke about the fact that we have this terrible situation in terms of basically like liar's loans in the realm of auto loans.
Right. Tranching them.
Right.
And
so that's still there. I mean, you know, the question right now around the American economy, where every advantage has gone to the rich because we've had the zero, you know, the free money coming out of the Fed and stuff to the right. financial institutions. It's worked for the people who hold assets. Is do we have a big bubble on the stock markets? And that's an open question.
Yeah, I think that kind of falls into the category of, you know, I think it's fairly obvious we do.
Yeah.
I was going to say something you can't say on the radio. Anyhow,
it's a pleasure.
Kalin Minsky, great to have
you. Thank you
so
much.
We'll be back. Thank you. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. In roughly 15 minutes, we are going, about 12 minutes, we are going to be playing a new movie here on this program that I helped write, and I'm in it, that that is narrated by Leonardo DiCaprio and produced by the DiCaprio Foundation, funded by the DiCaprio Foundation. About climate change. You can go over to greenworldrising.org right now and see it. It's called Restoration, and it's about using natural systems to recover from the damage that we've done to the natural systems. But you'll learn all about it. We're going to play that. It's just a little 8-minute video on a YouTube video right now that's what it's going to always be. And we just put it up today. And like I said, greenworldrising.org is where you can. Where you can check it out, where you can see the thing. So, and it's going to be a lot of fun. Wayne in Pompano Beach, Florida. Hey, Wayne, what's on your mind today?
Yes, hello, Tom. How you doing?
Great. What's up?
I've been living down here in South Florida since the early 70s, and I'd like to give a different perspective to the whole Rubio thing.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, if the Cubans hadn't all basically ran away, Castro would be a footnote in history. I mean, what happened was instead of standing up and fighting for their country, they basically all ran over here. And, you know, it's kind of like the little guy who wants to kick the butt of the big guy, but if his wife is stopping him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they stood over here and they yell and scream about they want to get rid of Castro.
Well, my take on this, Wayne, is that the wealthy people, I mean, the mafia and the wealthy people and a lot of that wealth, much of that wealth, maybe even most of that wealth, was ill-gotten gains. I mean, the Batista government was insanely corrupt, and the mafia basically ran Cuba, that they fled to Miami. And that's that generation that's dying off right now that wants to maintain the embargo against Cuba because they want to just, you know, freeze it in amber because they think that at some point in time when the Castro government falls, they'll be able to go in and make a claim for their land and get back the businesses that they had, get back the big fancy houses that they used to have, and that kind of thing. I personally may be wrong, but I think that that's what's animating. Yeah, but they're a dying breed, are they not, Wayne?
Absolutely. And when you stop and think about it, when they came here, the reason that they were accepted here were not conservative. They were liberal. These people were brought here. They were given low-cost business loans. They were given more benefits than any group of migrants in American history.
Yeah. And they continue to.
And yet Rubio, who benefited from this tremendous amount of welfare, turns up now he's a Republican, and he basically is talking about he wants to pull up the ladder. I mean, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, and pull up the ladder is exactly what he's talking about doing. You're right. Excellent point, Wayne. Thank you for the call, and thanks for making it. Ken in Perrington, Michigan. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Yeah, you were talking earlier about something that could get people motivated, especially, you know, for the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that documentary recently that Vincent Bugliosi had on,
right,
about the trying of a president. And I think if we could get that on some kind of primetime national network like CNBC or some MSNBC or something like that, what a difference that could make, because it would really show people just how crooked these guys are.
I think it would. It ain't going to happen, though, because all the networks are owned by big corporations who need to suck up to Republicans along with Democrats in order to keep their tax breaks and keep their profits and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But I agree. And for people who don't know what Ken is talking about, Vince Bugliosi was the Los Angeles prosecuting attorney. He prosecuted Charlie Manson. He wrote a book about it called Helter Skelter, which was a New York Times bestseller. He's now he wrote a book called The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. And his thesis, which has now been made into a movie, the Prosecution of a President, I believe it is. Correct me if I'm wrong, Ken. And
no, that's
it. Okay. And basically, the premise of it is that George W. Bush lied us into a war. It was a criminal act that Bush committed to get us into that war in the first place. And therefore, every person who died in Iraq, every American soldier who died in Iraq, was actually murdered indirectly by George W. Bush. And that a local prosecutor in any jurisdiction across the United States, whether it's a state attorney general or a county prosecutor or a city prosecutor or, whatever it may be, they have, if a soldier died in Afghanistan in Iraq from their town, they have legal standing to prosecute George W. Bush for murder. And he's just been looking for somebody to do it. And, the tragedy of this, in my mind, is that Vince Bugliosi is at the end of his career, and he's quite elderly now, or maybe that's the wrong way to say it, not politically correct. I don't know, but he's getting increasingly frail and less able to go out and stomp on the circuit, right? But it's a brilliant movie, and tragically it's not going to appear on any network. But Ken, you're right, and people should check it out. Thanks a lot for the call. Demetrius in Northbrook, Illinois. Hey, Demetrius.
Hi. I saw a statistic again last night that hasn't changed, which really makes me upset. There's still around 22 soldiers committing suicide every single day today.
Yeah.
Every single day in this country. And we can't even seem to get them health care. I'm really upset with the Republicans, but I don't worry about them because they're just nuts anyways. Unless I see a change, I'm not going to pay attention to them. I'm really upset with the Democratic Party. They're not fighting for us. Very upset with them. They're really not fighting for us.
I disagree, Demetrius. I absolutely disagree. First of all, some really great legislation happened in the first 2 years of the Obama presidency. During that 74 days when he had a veto-proof Senate and he had a House that, Nancy Pelosi was running. And the astonishing amount of legislation that got passed that was then filibustered by Republicans in the Senate, things that, for example, would end the tax breaks that we give to big corporations when they ship factories and jobs overseas. They got vetoed. They got, filibustered by the Republicans. It's astonishing. Anyhow, we'll be back 28 minutes past now.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Coming up next, Restoration, a new movie with Leonardo DiCaprio and me, right after the break. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And as promised, you can see this on the website greenworldrising.org. It's titled Restoration. It is the fourth in a series of four short, under 10-minute videos that we've produced with Leonardo DiCaprio and his dad, George DiCaprio, and Earl Katz, and Lila Connors put the thing together. Lila is absolutely brilliant, and the work that she does, and Tree Media, the whole thing. So here it is. Here is this. It was literally just rolled out in the last few hours. Here it is. Here's Restoration.
Climate change is pushing our civilization to shift to a new economy based on sustainable energy. As this transition is happening, we are also discovering that keys to slowing down climate change exist all around us in nature. When we plug into the wisdom of nature and work alongside Earth's ecosystems, we discover new and exciting innovations. Many are already underway. It is this partnership with nature that will solve our most pressing climate concerns and create the building blocks for a civilization that works alongside nature, not against it.
In the modern era, we forgot our interconnection with nature. Our technology let us grow beyond the limits nature imposed on us. Our economic system, based on extraction of resources, sped up this separation. Now plants and animals are going extinct all around us. But we destroy and ignore the natural world at our peril because much of what our planet does protects us and reverses the damage done by our industry.
All that we do, all that we have, all that we need is basically provided by nature, from fresh water to fresh air, to the productivity of farmland, to the sequestration of carbon, to the replenishment of fisheries, to the protection of communities from flooding and everything else by forests and wetlands. All of these things are being done by nature for us pretty much for free, and we're diminishing them as we go on this journey towards endless economic growth.
Since pre-industrial times, the oceans have become about 30% more affected by ocean acidification because it's absorbed roughly a quarter of all the carbon dioxide that's been released through human activities. And that's a problem because it changes the chemistry of the ocean. And so it makes it more difficult for those creatures to build their shells and to grow. Organisms like corals and coral reefs.
Yes, the oceans are absorbing carbon dioxide. There's two primary ways that they do it. They're both critical for buffering us from climate change. Number one, the creatures living at the surface has photosynthesis and it's taking up the carbon in a biological way. The second way is dissolving the pure gas of CO2 into the ocean, and the colder the waters, the faster that gas goes in.
There's also a lot that the planet is actually doing to help us mitigate climate change. If you look at some of the coastal ecosystems, systems like tidal marshes and mangroves and seagrass beds, they actually take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and then trap it or mineralize it into the sediments, essentially mitigate climate change.
Forestation is a well-known way to sequester carbon and other plant materials as well. There's a big movement at the international level to save the rainforest, to prevent them from being clear-cut for farming or burnt down for farming and ranching, and to reforest those areas that have been. So those are the natural ways to collaborate with nature to compensate for some of our energy use.
Biodiversity is biosecurity. The more biodiverse an ecosystem is, the better it is able to respond to catastrophia, to human impacts, to pollution impacts. The soil, as it builds up the humus, carbon is being sequestered into the soil. And then as the soil debris and the wood debris builds up in the ecosystem, the carbon bank is being built as well. So you're not liberating this into the atmosphere.
While nature is doing all these things for us for free, our systems should also work alongside nature, further accelerating ecological benefits. Agriculture off fossil fuels can put ancient sunlight back in the ground while also feeding the world with current sunlight.
Regenerative organic agriculture can not only reduce climate change, but reverse climate change. And here's how it works. Photosynthesis relies on the ability of a plant to pull carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and then using the energy from the sun and water and nutrients from the soil, create carbohydrates. If we could generalize across the globe regenerative organic practices, we could actually sequester more than 100% of the current annual CO2 emissions in deserts, in jungles, in temperate zones. We can put carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and put it back into the ground whence it came.
The power of nature and its secrets can also lead to exciting new innovations. By studying and mimicking nature, something called biomimicry, we can unlock many of the answers that will fix our most pressing problems.
Life had 3.8 billion years on this planet, and in that time has really figured out how to live here gracefully. So energy efficiency, material use, absolutely not have any waste, have cyclic processes, chemistries that are life friendly. In almost every realm we look at, there's enormous data bank of biological intelligence that until recently we've been ignoring, and that's changing now with biomimicry. Engineers, chemists, material scientists, the people who make our world are asking, has nature already solved this? And is there a model out there that I can emulate? In conserving energy, there's a company called Regen that has studied how ants and bees very efficiently forage and communicate with one another. They've taken that and put it in a software program that reduces appliance use of energy by 25-30% because the appliances are actually communicating with one another and dialing down their energies when they're not needed. The company called Novomer as taking CO2 and turning it into biodegradable plastics by studying how plants have done this. There's a company called Calera that's studying the coral reef recipe, and they're taking CO2 out of smokestacks and putting seawater through it and precipitating out concrete, which is the biggest building material in the world, using dissolved CO2.
An EPA grant, phase one, for microfiltration, filtering gray water of E. coli, and we found a mushroom called the garden giant that's exceptionally good at capturing E. coli, cleaning water, and is plant friendly. That's a real good example.
There's a wind turbine, it's a company called Whale Power in Canada, that has scalloped edges, and that is taken from a very efficient drag reduction strategy on the flipper of a humpback whale. It reduces drag by 32%.
We are learning that nature holds secrets we depend on, yet we are nearing a tipping point driven by our culture that thinks it does not need nature. For us to endure, we must stop eroding the natural treasures all around us and allow for the regenerative power of our planet to take hold.
We depend on these natural systems, especially the life support systems, and we need to modify our behavior to collaborate with them and certainly not to destroy them.
We only have 10% of the wood debris in the forest than we did just a few hundred years ago. And the ecosystem now is being stressed out, then diseases spread. And so now we have entered into a period of viral storms. We have massive amounts of pollution. We have water quality issues.
Those very systems are actually being lost at the rate of about 2% a year. And so very concrete action is make sure we protect these habitats and where they've been destroyed, restore them. Obviously, ultimately, we have to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere.
So many hundreds of millions of tons of the CO2 that now vex us, that now threaten our existence, came right from the soil. Let's put it back.
It's an all-hands-on-deck moment. We need to reinvest in the biodiversity of the ecosystem because ultimately that's the safest route for us.
Absolutely. We have to protect the blue carbon. It's much easier to preserve the natural systems that were evolved to be very efficient than we could ever recreate or engineer.
Unlocking nature's secrets will help us solve the climate crisis. Working alongside nature will create a civilization that will be infinitely sustainable. The time has come to build this world now.
And to learn more about how to work with and restore nature, go to greenworldrising.org. And play the credit roll here for those of you who are watching on TV, but back to me. This is serious stuff. I mean, it's like figuring out how, okay, we've done this damage to our environment, a damage that, if you remember our last hour's video, which is up over at greenworldrising.org as well, damage that could literally lead to the extinction of human beings, and not to mention a lot of other life forms. But hey, you know, let's start with number one, I guess. And so, you know, we issued the warning, as it were, the lookout. And then since then, we've produced three other videos basically all saying, here are dimensions of the problem. This one is a solutions video, and it's using the tools that nature has. And nature's got a lot of really good tools for healing itself. So this is, I'm very pleased to be part of this video and this little documentary, and hope you have a chance to see it. Check out greenworldrising.org. Pass it along to your friends. Tweet it. Facebook it. You know, get it out there, please, because it's an important message. It is possible. You know, we don't have to throw our hands up in the air, and there's a lot being done, and it's being done even in the face of Republican obstruction. It's being done because it needs to be done. I mean, there are businesses now that are using as their business model, hey, it's called biomimicry. Let's do what nature does and use that technology of nature to sequester carbon, to stabilize our atmosphere, and ultimately also, by the way, to replace the crazy fossil fuels that we use. So check it out. It's at greenworldrising.org. 15 minutes before the hour, back with your calls and more of the news of the day and my thoughts on it right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can drop into our live chat room. It's free, it's fun, it's cool. And greenworldrising.org. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And Jesse in Chico, California. Hey, Jesse, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. It's good to finally get to you. I've been watching for a couple of weeks now. I'm interested in your program.
Thank you. Pardon my sneezes. I'm sorry. Back to you, Jesse.
That's all right. I think your film there was great. There's some things that we forget, though. I said, I'm thinking about it. The draft was a good thing for the military, but getting everybody back to work and everything with all the projects we need to do, we keep forgetting that out of every depression or we've gone through, our governments always went back to the manual labor force and put them back to work, and the MJT has been the best learning tool.
Right. Yeah, yet, that's absolutely what.
If you listen to the Republicans, right now the Republicans are stating that they want to get more people back to work. And here's the one thing that I think both parties, if they just put, we'd be back at work.
Right. So the one thing that the Republicans are missing, I'm not sure I understand what you're saying. I mean, the way that I would say it is that if you want to put people back to work, you need to stimulate the economy. If you want to stimulate the economy, this is just using the private sector. If you want to stimulate the economy, then raise the wages of people at the bottom of the wage scale, and you will have a very, very well-stimulated economy. Thank you very much. In addition to that, if you want to bring in the public sector, if, you know, we have a $2 to $3 trillion infrastructure deficit, if we were to rebuild those roads and bridges and water systems and septic systems and add another $500 million or $1 trillion in there for, you know, building out national broadband networks and things like that, unemployment would be at zero. We would put everybody back to work, just like FDR did after the Great Depression.
That's exactly right. And you have to put it like this. Everybody has learned from hands-on experience, from our grandfathers to our fathers and that. Usually they had the opportunity to go to work and work, learning something on the job because they didn't get to go to school long. They were either farming or construction. And it's the same thing today. A lot of our schools, like Atlanta, where they got them from cheating on the test, well, they turned right around. You've got all these kids that were deprived of an education that could have used just any basic job that somebody would have instructed them how to do that would have been teachable.
Yeah, yeah. Well said, Jesse. Jesse, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Henry, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Lewiston, California. You had a question about the Masons?
Yes, I have. I've heard several years ago a story or something about the Masons organization, the Brotherhood of Masons, want to control the world. They're going to destroy America and the world, and they want to control the world.
Well, they helped create America. You know, George Washington was a Mason. His swearing-in ceremony, his inauguration, was a Masonic ritual or parade or whatever. You can see old wood cuttings of it in, you know, the National Archives. But I don't think that the Masons have any power anymore. I mean, you know, Joseph Smith ripped them off and turned it into Mormonism. He added, you know, a little bit of religion to it. And, you know, the Mormons are basically just, they're, you know, most of their rituals and things are old Masonic rituals. But, you know, if you're looking for a conspiracy, the people who want to rule the world or do rule the world and are messing with it in a bad way, you don't have to look for hidden things. You can look at what's right out in front of us, which is the banksters all over the world, you know, pushing deregulation, pushing neoliberalism, and owning the world. And Henry, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Marco Rubio's, Machano just reminded me, Marco Rubio's new slogan for his presidential campaign is a new American century. As in the project for a new American century that Jeb Bush signed the letter in 1998 to President Clinton asking him to please invade Iraq right now because we don't like Saddam Hussein and we want his oil. Is that what you're talking about, Marco Rubio? That's pretty spooky. That's pretty spooky stuff. Tom in St. Paul, listening on KTNF. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I want to bring back the question you asked at the beginning of the show regarding Lincoln's 150th anniversary. But first, I want to mention, you know, there are only four presidential memorials on our hallowed mall in D.C., and that would be Lincoln, FDR, Washington, and Jefferson.
Right.
And you asked at the beginning, on this 150th day of Lincoln's death, what has become of the GOP? And probably because the GOP tries to, you know, spin and co-opt liberal Lincoln's legacy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I have to ask, what has become of the Democratic Party? You know, 3 days ago was the 70th anniversary of the greatest president of the 20th century, ranked by most historians, both left and right, right next to Lincoln, FDR.
Right.
Hillary Clinton announces her candidacy on the 70th anniversary, Sunday, April 12th, and she cannot even mention a quote, not even from Eleanor Roosevelt, to leverage the legacy, the progressive legacy of this greatest leader. I mean, what are they, just retarded? It's just amazing.
It's a good question. It's a good question, especially since she's presumably going to run, at least through the primary, as a progressive populist or something close to that. I mean, the things that she's saying so far are the sort of things that could be interpreted as being progressive. But, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I'm with you.
You know, it just amazes me that, like, again, back to the messaging, right?
Yeah. It's always all about the messaging. Because the substance, I mean, you know, the Democratic Party is reasonably good on the substance. The Republican Party is absolutely horrible on the substance, and there's no disputing that. There's a huge difference between these two parties. But the Republican Party is really good at messaging, and the Democratic Party is only mediocre at it. Tom, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to KTNF. Chuck in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hey, Chuck, what's up?
Yeah, good afternoon, Tom. I really enjoy your show. I wanted to comment, and I'd also like to hear your comments concerning the fracking that's going on in the Midwest, especially in Oklahoma and the surrounding states, that are causing, that are responsible for hundreds of earthquakes.
Right.
That are causing a multitude of devastation. And yet the conservatives are saying, and the oil people, of course, are saying they're not related whatsoever, or they are related, minimal.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do about that? I mean, it's been in the literature lately in the New Yorker. And
I think Chuck, what's going to happen is that a certain critical mass will be achieved where, and good on Josh Fox, by the way, for his Gasland 1 and Gasland 2 movies, which have really exposed fracking and what's going on with fracking in this country. But I think that a critical mass will be achieved of people who are just, you know, who's sick and tired of having their water be flammable, having their quality of life stink, I mean, quite literally, and who are tired of being frightened at 3 o'clock in the morning by an earthquake and the possibility of the chimney falling or the entire house falling around them. And they'll do something about it. We're seeing countries start to do things, you know, like this. We've got a couple of states and counties that have banned fracking. It's, you know, step by step. I think we're going to move in the right direction on this. The big problem is that Dick Cheney, who, you know, used to be the CEO of Halliburton, when Halliburton invented fracking, Dick Cheney walked this thing, you know, past the EPA and got an exemption from clean water standards and clean air standards, EPA standards, for the fracking industry. So they can just pour any kind of poison that they want into these fracking wells and into the waste wells, the injection wells afterwards, and they have no accountability, no answer, you know, they don't have to answer to anybody. That's something, and we don't know what they're putting in these chemicals. And I would bet almost anything that a substantial portion of it is toxic waste that they used to have to pay to get rid of, and now they're actually, you know, being able to use it as a fracking material, and they no longer have to pay to get rid of these things, which makes the industry even more profitable. But I think that we're going to see a public sentiment on this change over time, Chuck. At least I sure hope so. The other thing, and Chuck, thank you for the call. The other thing about fracking is that it is a short-term thing. You know, they frack a well, and that well will produce gas for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. But odds are it's not going to produce, or oil, depending on what they're fracking into, it's not going to produce much more than, at the very most, a half a decade to a decade. So in a way, they're running a Ponzi scheme. You know, they run some fracked wells. They're making a profit off that. They use the profit from that to run the next fracked wells. They make a profit off that. But eventually, these fracked wells, and should the responsibility, the legal responsibility, the expense of the damage that these fracking operations are causing, should that ever fall to the fracking companies, they'll be out of business. They'll be out of business. I mean, this is almost like the nuclear industry. So anyhow, Gary in Lakewood, Washington. Gary, we have 1 minute till the end of the program, the end of the hour. It's yours.
Tom, a pleasure to speak with you. I'm a retired geophysicist from the United States Geological Survey. If you Google Gary Barton, Trumbull County, Ohio, you'll see one of my reports studying oil and gas drilling and water quality. USGS may have some information about fracking and earthquake activity, number one. Number two, my messaging, I changed my messaging. I'm doing local talks out here in Tacoma. I'm a World War II progressive. And when I talk to conservatives saying I'm a World War II progressive, they take me differently. You were just talking about messaging.
Mm-hmm.
That is my new messaging, and it seems to be working. Because when you say World War II progressive, people stand back and go like, what is that? And you talk about it.
Right.
And you talk about...
You'd have to be almost 70, though, to say you're a World War II progressive, wouldn't you?
Well, I grew up in an Eisenhower farm.
Yeah, okay. Gary, we're out of time, but thank you. That's a great meme, World War II progressives. I love it. Thanks so much for being with us today. Don't forget greenworldrising.org. Check it out. It's a great video. Share it with your friends. And the big don't forget, of course, democracy begins with you. It's not a spectator sport. We've got to participate. Tag Gory. I'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.